STV.
It was stuff made for history books, renewed calls even for Trump to get the Nobel Peace Prize. But when taking a second look at the meeting or the historic summit that took place between the U.S. president and the North Korean leader, it appears that this wasn't as historic in substance as the meeting was. For example, there wasn't a concrete agreement on core issues. Now, in this debate, we will look at other revelations about this meeting which fall short of actual commitments.
Short and fat, little rocket man versus lunatic old. 7 months after the U.S. president got into an undiplomatic name-calling spat with the North Korean leader, the two have now made history by meeting face-to-face in Singapore. Only a day after his 72nd birthday on Monday, Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to hold direct talks with the North Korean leader. In front of a row of U.S. and North Korean flags, a previously unthinkable sight, Trump and Kim sounded optimistic about the possibility of sorting out key differences.
I think that working in close harmony with you, Mr. President, of course there will be challenges ahead, but I am willing to do this great work.
Mr. Chairman, it's a great honor to be with you, and I know we'll have tremendous success together. And we'll solve a big problem, a big dilemma that until this point has been unable to be solved. I know that working together, we will get it taken care of. So, great honor. Thank you very much.
After a working lunch, the two leaders signed what they called a comprehensive joint document. As part of the agreement, Trump committed to provide security guarantees to Pyongyang. In return, Kim reaffirmed his commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. After wrapping up the Singapore summit, President Trump held a news conference during which he pledged to stop war games on North Korea's doorstep. He also said U.S. sanctions on the North will remain in place until Pyongyang completely dismantles its nuclear program.
The sanctions will come off when we are sure that the nukes are no longer a factor. Sanctions played a big role, but they'll come off at that point. I hope it's going to be soon, but they'll come off. They, as you know, and as I've said, the sanctions right now remain. But at a certain point, I actually look forward to taking them off. And they'll come off when we know we're down the road where it's not going to happen. Nothing's going to happen, okay?
The U.S. is speaking of security guarantees in return for complete denuclearization of the North. But the fate of former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, who was toppled by the West after abandoning his country's nuclear program, and Trump's recent withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal were salutary lessons to Kim. The North Korean leader knows that respecting international law is very low on the list of the Trump administration's priorities that has pledged to put America first.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joins us from San Francisco. And we have writer and lecturer Jonathan Fryer, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Jonathan Fryer, let me start with you and get your reaction to what occurred in Singapore first.
Well, it was a great piece of showmanship, essentially. We have to remember that Donald Trump was not only a businessman, but also a television star before he went into being a president of the United States. And he likes those sort of big, highly visible efforts. And I think without a doubt, he was trying to emulate Richard Nixon. Remember 1972, President Nixon went to China and really led to the People's Republic of China being brought in from the cold in international relations. And I think Mr. Trump is hoping that he will go down in history as the man that brought North Korea in from the cold, though of course North Korea is a much smaller player than China was.
Well, Richard Becker, I'm sure you're aware of some of the things that this historic summit, as it was called, is falling short of. The news is trickling in. Give us first your reaction on this, and of course, what your observations are in terms of how some have characterized this to be as aspirational in nature.
Well, I think that that's true, and that's not surprising, given the fact that there's so many different sides to the negotiations that are going on. I do think we have to say that with all that we know about Donald Trump and all the negatives and what we've seen from him, still, it's better to move in the direction away from war, and particularly away from nuclear war. So that is a very, I think, a very important development. And I think, of course, we know Trump and all of his character, his characteristics, his features, and so forth, as a person and as a so-called political leader. But I think in the overall realm of things, that it's really important that this development is taking place, and we know that from the Korean point of view, they're going to wonder, the North Korean point of view, they're going to wonder if it will be a repeat of the framework agreement that took place 20-some years ago, where really the United States did not meet its commitments any, to that agreement. And so that was really what led to the decision by North Korea to go full force. That and the 2002 speech where George W. Bush called North Korea part of the so-called axis of evil in a ludicrous speech, pushed them to go full forward with their nuclear program.
Well, Jonathan Fryer, let me ask you, do you know what was declared in the Singapore summit in terms of what was signed?
Well, very little that was really particularly clear. I mean, there was a commitment in rather vague terms that the Americans would pull troops out from South Korea and stop what we call war games, in other words, military exercises, which have been a key element of American foreign policy in East Asia. And clearly, Mr. Trump is then pursuing what he earlier had argued he would do in the Middle East, but then reneged on that, withdrawing American presence from that region. But I have to say, I think really the North Koreans must be awfully pleased with what's happened in Singapore, because they have got much more out of the summit than Mr. Trump has brought back to Washington or is taking back to Washington, because North Korea and Kim Jong-un himself are now absolutely center stage, back on the world stage, and we're seen all around by billions of people on television and in newspapers today. That's a huge change from a situation of only months ago, where North Korea was seen to be almost the most pariah state in the world, with a dreadful human rights reputation and years of starvation during famine in the 1990s. Suddenly, Kim Jong-un is being cheered in the streets of Singapore by local people saying, "We love you."
Well, you know, I would think, Richard Becker, that alarm bells should be going off at this point in terms of how Trump has said that they are going to scrap the war games, and also that perhaps they may remove U.S. troops, because this was without reference to any North Korean concessions in that regards. I mean, here you have a case where even Pentagon officials, they're scrambling for a clear message about this U.S. military presence in South Korea after what Trump said. Because that would leave, I would think, North Korea in a position where, can we believe what Trump has said or not? Because you're getting in the news not only a reaction from Pentagon officials, from both Republicans and Democrats, who are scratching their heads as to why Trump is doing that. Why do you think Trump did that? Is that a knee-jerk reaction from him? Because he didn't obviously get anything in return.
Well, I think we could look at it a slightly different way, too, that North Korea said in the statement, in the joint statement, that they would go for complete denuclearization. So that would be an enormous concession on the part of North Korea. And we should look at what these war games, and they are these war maneuvers, have been year after year. They have been openly saying from the Pentagon that they are rehearsing an invasion of North Korea, and then on the other hand, that they're also rehearsing a decapitation strategy, meaning the head of the leadership in North Korea. I mean, you couldn't be more provocative than that. I mean, that is the accurate term to apply to those war games. I think the Pentagon is shocked that those words came out of Trump's mouth. But there's no, you know, the other big thing in all of this is the sanctions, which have been devastating. The sanctions have been devastating even to much of the trade between China and North Korea. China is North Korea's main trading partner. But Trump said, no, we're not lifting the sanctions until there's complete denuclearization. So, you know, there's a lot that's there. And I think the idea that North Korea somehow got a great deal here and the United States didn't, or Trump, you know, didn't get a good deal or something like that, I think that's completely false.
Well, but don't you think, okay, Jonathan Fryer, that maybe we should, just in what has happened, at least based on what has occurred, make some conclusions? And most importantly here, denuclearization. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the understanding is that the North Korean leader said there should be denuclearization in the Korean Peninsula. And the only thing that he has admitted to doing is that the test site, the nuclear test site, that can be destroyed. But nothing on denuclearization
indeed,
of North Korea.
That engine, that's right. I mean, the text only mentions some closing down an engine-making facility, these sort of rather minor steps. So the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is seen, obviously, as a long-term prospect. And the Americans will, without doubt, particularly from the Pentagon side and urged by the South Koreans, be now pressing to see actually what the route to denuclearization will be. And this could be something that could go on for many years. And I think we have to remember that when Nixon opened the way to China in 1972, there was then an extensive and very, very complex diplomatic maneuver by the then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who was a great, formidable character on the world scene. Now, Mike Pompeo, Trump's Secretary of State, has got that task, and he's by no means as competent in any way as Dr. Kissinger, for all his faults. So I think we mustn't assume that everything is going to go ahead smoothly, and indeed, given Mr. Trump's unpredictability and the way that he slapped down all of his European allies and next-door neighbor Justin Trudeau in Canada at the recent G7 summit, wouldn't be at all surprised if he suddenly started saying, well, no, Mr. Kim isn't the very talented man that he called him in the press conference today, but still the little rocket man.
Okay. Let's see here. Richard Becker, I'm going to mention a couple things that I want to get your reaction on. They might not seem that important, but according to some, they are. For example, during the press conference that Trump was at, when he was talking at length, there was no presence of Kim Jong-un there. And another was there was no invitation to Kim Jong-un to the White House, and for Trump to reject an invitation from Kim Jong-un to go to Pyongyang. What kind of signals or interpretations can be made out of those?
Well, I think that that's probably part of the ongoing give and take, the negotiating process that's going on. I think that we have to see the fact that Trump could go to Singapore, and after saying he wasn't going to Singapore, and just a few days, you know, and then a day later saying, oh, I am going to Singapore. It shows how really unpredictable the whole course of this is. And we cannot forget that Trump came in and pulled out of the JCPOA in regard to Iran. And in fact, I think one of the real possibilities out of what we're seeing happen in regard to Korea could be to try to put the Korea crisis on hold for a period of time in order to direct U.S. attention in a very hostile way, an even more hostile way, toward Iran. I think that's a very real possibility and a very real danger. So Trump has gone all over the map on foreign policy in ways which have defied the traditional negotiations and the traditional relationship between different states, what are considered allies and what are considered enemies. The U.S. is in contention with all of them on one level or another. I think it's important to remember. But I think that the real danger, one of the real dangers right now, is in regard to what U.S. policy and U.S.-Israeli policy and U.S.-Israeli-Saudi Arabia policy is going to be in the next phase toward Iran.
Well, if we're going to go along that route, Jonathan Fryer, then let's take a look at the pieces on the chessboard. So you have the U.S. president sitting in front of North Korea, and then you have these other external factors, one big one, China. The other one, which I'm not too sure, maybe you can tell us what significance that plays, and that is the presence of Russia when it comes to North Korea and China. And then beyond that, you have Iran and, of course, some of the other countries that our guest Richard Becker talked about. And the reason why I'm mentioning all these external pieces is because they can all tie in terms of getting concessions, giving this and getting that. Do you see them all being tied up with each other somehow?
Not very easily, quite frankly. I think it's important to note that Russia's influence with North Korea is only a shadow of what it used to be when the Soviet Union was still in existence. But the behavior of Kim Jong-un's father really put off the Russians quite strongly. And North Korea has relied very, very heavily on its links with China, and it has been China that really has backed North Korea, saved it from complete economic ruin, and been, to a certain extent, its ally on the international stage. But another country which we have to mention, which hasn't so far come up, is Japan, because it is Japan that was more worried than anybody else about the development of North Korea's nuclear weapons, because Japan, of course, was very much within range of the sorts of ballistic missiles that North Korea has been testing and developing. So I think what we have to see now is whether there is any really sensible way forward in which both Koreas, North and South, and Japan can come to some sort of negotiated agreement to promote peace and security in the region. And yes, that will involve some external players, including the United States, including China, maybe not Russia, but maybe Russia will want to be part of it as being one of the five permanent members of the United Nations.
Well, Richard Bricker, I'm going to address the same question to you in a sense, but I'd like more to focus on the way that China is going to use these talks and how much of an influence it was to begin with, and also are there any type of backstage dealings when it comes to, for example, the U.S. presence in the South China Sea? I'm guessing that along with the trade dispute that China and the U.S. have, perhaps indirectly are involved in these talks.
Well, I think that we have to remember that Kim Jong-un visited Beijing twice in the period just leading up to these talks. So obviously China very much wants to see a lowering of the temperature, of a move away from the danger of war, and particularly of nuclear war. And also the trade relations between China and North Korea, the DPRK, are extremely important to DPRK, but they also are important to China. And there's been a big fall off in trade in some of those areas, and I think China would like to see that reversed. And I think that China very much is interested in helping North Korea's economy further recover. It is recovering at this time, at least by all appearances. I wanted to mention one other thing about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The question has to be raised is, does that include U.S. Trident submarines? In other words, sitting off the coast of the Korean Peninsula, the most deadly instrument of war ever created. One Trident can target up to 200 different sites independently with nuclear missiles. And so I think that that's a part of the whole discussion that gets left out in the mainstream media here is under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the United States and the other nuclear weapons powers are supposed to be denuclearizing themselves and have been supposed to been doing that since the beginning. And instead, what the U.S. is doing is announcing a $1 trillion plus modernization of its nuclear weapons, including seaborne weapons as well as ICBMs and bomber drop nuclear weapons. So, you know, we should keep that in mind as part of the framework, the larger framework of talking about the issue of nuclear weapons.
Again, I'm looking at some of the reactions coming through here. Senate Majority Leader McConnell saying that if Trump reaches a significant agreement with North Korea, he hopes it will be a treaty. And yet you have some other Republicans that are reeling in why there was a concession given by Donald Trump. So Jonathan Fryer, this deal now is going to move forward in terms of it being somewhat executionable. But the whole idea of denuclearization is what is now left up in the air. How is that going to work out where you can get some movement going? You would think that the first thing that North Korea would look for would be sanctions relief, but Trump and his team have flatly rejected that.
Yes, indeed. Obviously, from the North Koreans' point of view, the sanctions are absolutely crucial. As Richard mentioned, their effect has been really very bad, and obviously they would like relief from that. But I think there is another element which it is important to raise and to see something perhaps from the perspective of South Korea and what people in Seoul and the rest of the southern part of the Korean Peninsula are hoping for, because the elephant in the room is the reunion of Korea. We have to remember that until the end of the Second World War, Korea was one united nation. It had been a Japanese colony, but it's divided as a result of the Korean War in the 1950s. And most Koreans in their hearts hope that one day the whole country can be reunified. Now, for that to happen, there's got to be a lot of economic as well as political reform in the North, and also there's got to be a huge amount of confidence building. And I think we will see, in parallel with the moving forward slowly on denuclearization, there will be much more effort put on confidence building between the two Koreas.
And finally, Mr. Becker, to you, parallel type situation, and not completely the same, was what happened with Iran when it came to the JCPOA. Do you think that North Korea is going to take its time when it comes to commitments given by the U.S. in order to see how the U.S. abides by any commitments that it gives North Korea so that they don't get burnt?
Well, I would expect so. Given the long, drawn-out, difficult negotiations of the JCPOA and then Trump coming in and withdrawing the U.S. from it, I mean, there's a very long history. The United States actually has a terrible, terrible history when it comes to treaties. And if you want to consult anybody about this definitively, you can talk to the Native American people of the United States. Every one of hundreds and hundreds of treaties was broken by the U.S. government. And certainly that was true in regard to Korea in the 1990s.
Right.
And now we've seen it in regard to Iran.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Answer Coalition, Richard Becker there. Thank you, Jonathan Fryer, writer and lecturer. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.